talk is observational signatures in loop quantum cosmology, and I'm going to talk about a work made in collaboration with Abai and with Will Nelson. And well, the question mark in the title is due to the fact that this is a work in progress, so it is possible that this is not a final picture, and it is not impossible that new issues arise, but at this point we have we think that the complete picture is made, and this is basically what I want to communicate. So let's go to next slide, please. The content of my talk is the following. I want to start talking about a summary of the main ideas of inflation, and in particular, how inflation is able to generate a spectrum of cosmic inhomogeneities. I will assume that not everybody is familiar with the idea of inflation, so I will start from scratch. After that, I want to talk about loop quantum cosmology, and in particular, the relation with inflation. And at the end of the talk, I want to show you what is our concrete proposal to get observational signatures of loop quantum gravity, and I will quickly summarize our main results so far. Let's go to slide number three, please. Let's start talking about inflation. Well, the main motivation for inflation came out in 1981 by Alan Guth, and he realizes that an exponential expansion of the early universe is able to solve the problems of the Big Bang model related with the initial conditions, the so-called flatness problem and horizon problem. However, this initial motivation has been criticized by prominent researchers in general relativity by saying that there is no a precise mathematical way in which inflation actually solves those problems. Then, why is inflation so popular? If the initial motivation is not really well posed, why is inflation nowadays so popular? Well, the success of inflation nowadays comes from a different point and is related with the generation of cosmic inhomogeneities. Inflation provides a compelling argument rooted on profound ideas on quantum Victorian curve space-time for the origin of the cosmic inhomogeneities as amplification of vacuum fluctuation. So let's start talking about the inflationary background. The main assumption of inflation is the existence of a scalar field, the so-called inflaton field, with a suitable potential. And in addition, the idea that there was a phase in the early universe in which the matter content of the universe was dominated by the potential energy of this scalar field. Generically, one can expand the inflaton field as a homogeneous part, which only depends on time, plus inhomogeneities. And now one can use the fact that the observation of the CMB is telling us that at the time of recombination, the inhomogeneities of the universe were one part in 10 to the 5. In addition, one can use the argument that inhomogeneities usually grow with time. So with this, one can assume that the inhomogeneities of the scalar field, of the inflaton field during inflation are negligible, and that justifies the use of perturbation theory. Now, it is trivial to write the stress tensor of this scalar field at zero order in perturbations, and it is given by the density and the pressure. The density is the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. The pressure is the kinetic minus the potential energy. And now, if we have that the energy is dominated by potential energy, it is trivial to show that the stress tensor of this scalar field is proportional to the metric, and then it acts in the Einstein equation as an effective cosmological constant. Then the space-time geometry is an expanded geometry which expands exponentially with time, where this h is the Hubble rate, and it is basically constant during this exponential expansion. Well, in cosmology, it is conventional to parameterize the constancy of the H parameter by two parameters, the so-called Slorer parameters, this epsilon and this eta parameter, which contain information about the time derivative of H. And in particular, the assumption that these two parameters are small, this is the so-called Slorer approximation. This Slorer approximation implies that H is very constant, and so the universe expands almost exponentially. Let's go to slide number three, please. Now, let's talk about inhomogeneities. As I said, the homogeneous part of the inflaton field is a classical source producing the inflationary background. Now, in this inflationary background, one can treat the inflaton perturbation as a quantum field, as a scalar field itself, propagating in this classical spacetime, and one quantize it. Then, using generic arguments in quantum field theory in curved spacetime, we have the following results. Point number one, the inflationary background expansion is able to amplify vacuum fluctuations of these inflaton perturbations and spontaneously create from the vacuum a spectrum of scalar perturbations. Additionally, this spectrum is going to induce, via the Einstein equations, a primordial spectrum of density perturbations. On the other hand, number two, exactly for the same reason, inflation is also able to amplify vacuum fluctuations of metric tensor perturbations. This is gravity waves, and so inflation is also going to generate a primordial spectrum of gravity waves. These primordial perturbations are the seeds of the cosmic inhomogeneities that we observe today in the CMB inhomogeneities and in the galaxy distribution. Let's go to slide number four, please. Let's talk a little bit more about scalar perturbations. As I said, that scalar perturbations are characterized by inflaton perturbations, but because mathematical reasons, it is more convenient to characterize scalar perturbations by this variable R. This R variable is the so-called comoving curvature perturbation, and it is just a suitable combination of inflaton perturbations and this capital C. This capital C is just a scalar potential of the metric, and this combination is such that the R variable is gauge invariant, and this is the reason why it is more convenient. Then one can quantize these scalar perturbations in the inflationary background. First of all, one can use the homogeneity of the spacetime to Fourier expand the field operator. And now the field operator in momentum space, it is just a combination of creation and annihilation operators. This is the A and A dagger. And these R sub K are the standard mode function, which are a complete basis of the wave equation in momentum space. Now, one can use the symmetries of the spacetime background to choose a particular form of the mode function, and because the inflationary universe is almost the sitter, one can use the sitter symmetries to choose a particular form of the mode function, and this is given in equation one. The explicit form is not important. This tau is just the so-called conformal time, and H1 is a Hankel function with index mu, that, as I said, the form is not important. And now, with these modes, one can define the vacuum state as the state annihilated by all the annihilation operators. And this is the famous so-called Bunch-Davis vacuum. This vacuum is just a vacuum which is well adapted to the inflationary geometry. Now, let me make a remark. It is important to have in mind that in the CMB, in the observations of the CMB and in the galaxy distribution, we cannot see an infinite range of perturbations. We cannot see perturbations larger than the Hubble radius today, and we cannot see perturbations smaller than the resolution of our apparatus. So, for observational purposes, we only need to make assumptions about a finite range of modes that we are able to observe in the present universe. This is a range. This range is from K0 is the minimum K that we can see in the perturbations of the universe, and more or less 200 times K0 is the maximum K that we can see in the universe today. Let's go to slide number five, please. Now, if we assume that the field is in the vacuum state, we can characterize or compute the spectrum of perturbations by computing the different correlation functions of the field operator. And I'm going to do it in momentum space because this is conventional in cosmology. In number one, we have the mean of the field, which is trivially zero because the state is the vacuum. In number two, we have the two-point function. And in fact, if the spectrum of perturbations is a pure Gaussian spectrum, the two-point function contains all the information about the perturbation. Then a trivial computation tell us that the two-point function is given by the amplitude square of the modes times a Dirac delta function. And in cosmology, it is conventional to characterize this two-point function by the so-called power spectrum, which is defined in the last equality of equation 2. So this power spectrum is the quantity that characterizes the spectrum of perturbations in momentum space. Now, I want to call Tk to the so-called Hubble exit time for a mode k, and this Tk is defined in such a way that the physical wavelength corresponding to a given k, which depends on time because the physical wavelength is proportional to the scale factor, Tk is the time at which this physical wavelength equals the Hubble radius, where the Hubble radius is defined as 1 over the Hubble rate. Then we have that at a time much later than the Hubble radius, the power spectrum has the form that appears in the first box, which is proportional to h squared over epsilon, evaluated at Tk. So the power spectrum at a time later than Tk is a constant, and this is very important. The second quantity that characterizes the spectrum of perturbations is the so-called spectral index. This spectral index is measuring the dependence of the power spectrum on k, and it's such that if this ns is equal to 1, means that the power spectrum doesn't depend on k, and this is what is called exactly scale invariant spectrum. But explicit computation shows that ns minus 1 is not 0, but is minus 4 epsilon minus 2 eta. Epsilon and eta are the slow roll parameters, which are small, basically 1 over 100, but they are not 0. So inflation is predicting a spectrum of fluctuations which is nearly scale invariant. Now, what is interesting is that observations of the CMB, in particular the observation produced by WMAP 7 years, are qualitatively compatible with these predictions of inflation. You can see that the prediction for the ns minus 1, which is this number plus minus the error, sorry, there is a minus sign missing in front of the 0.032. So, but the important thing is that this measurement rules out as exactly a scale invariant spectrum. So the observations of the CMB are in qualitatively agreement with the predictions of inflation. And this is this is non-trivial at all. So let's go to the next slide, please. Now, in this slide, I just want to summarize the main picture of inflation and the main assumptions. In the plot, what is on the top left part of the slide, I am plotting time in the vertical axis, and in the horizontal axis, I am plotting two different quantities. In the red line, I am plotting the Hubble radius, and in the blue line, I am plotting a given physical wavelength with time. The plot has three parts. Starting from the bottom, we have the first part going from T on to Tn, which is inflation. T on is the onset of inflation, and Tn, the end of inflation. From Tn to T reg of recombination, we have a period of radiation dominated. And after T reg, we have a period of matter domination. Now, the main assumptions of inflation are the following. The first one is the existence of a scalar field and a phase of potential domination. This assumption produces the inflationary background. Second, at the onset of inflation, inflation assumes that all the modes, all the physical wavelengths of observational interest were well inside the Hubble radius. That means that the physical wavelengths at the onset of inflation were smaller, much smaller than the Hubble radius. And in addition, above the Planck length. So we can use quantum field theory in curved spacetimes as a good approximation. And the third assumption concerns the state of the perturbations at the onset of inflation, and is that scalar perturbations at the onset of inflation were in the vacuum state. Then inflation starts at T onset, where we only have vacuum fluctuations. Then the exponential expansion stretches out the physical wavelength of a mode until it gets larger than the Hubble radius. This is at the time Tk. At that time, inflation produces a spectrum of scalar perturbations given by the power spectrum. And the important thing is that this spectrum remains constant as far as the physical wavelength is larger than the Hubble radius. This is very important because this is telling us that the perturbations become or remain frozen as far as the mode is larger than the Hubble radius. In this clever way, inflation is able to avoid all the physics inside the Hubble radius that we really don't understand. That means that at a later time, when the modes re-enter the Hubble radius, when the mode became again smaller than the Hubble radius, the spectrum of fluctuations is still given by the power spectrum. At that time, which is a radiation-dominated period, we have the universe is filled of radiation, dark matter, matter, and each of these matter has a given density, pressure, velocities, and all these quantities satisfy a system, a complicated system of coupled differential equations that are the so-called Boltzmann equation. And the important thing is that the power spectrum generated during inflation are the initial conditions for these differential equations. So by solving the Boltzmann equations in a computer using as initial conditions the spectrum of perturbations generated during inflation, one obtains the plot that is on the right, in the top right part of the slide. This is the plot of the temperature inhomogeneities of the CMB. Please don't confuse it with the Planck black body curve. This is the inhomogeneities, the deviations from the mean temperature of the CMB, and the predictions of inflation are the red line, and you can see that the observations, which are the black points, are in perfect agreement with the observations. So this is at the precise way in which inflation is compatible with the observations of the CMB anisotropies. So even when some assumptions may seem ad hoc a priori, what one gets from inflation is far more than what one puts a priori, and that suggests that there must be some truth in this model. So let's go to slide number 7. There is any question at this point? Okay, then I want to talk about now loop quantum graph cosmology and the relation with inflation. First of all, I want to talk about the inflationary background. And in the last few years, there has been a lot of work in LQC, and today there is a coherent picture of the early universe, and I want to very briefly summarize this picture. First of all, cosmological singularities have been shown to be resolved in a variety of models, Friedman-Robertson-Walker, Bianchi models, Gaudi models. Second, in Friedman-Robertson-Walker models have been studied most extensively using analytical and numerical methods. Three, the Big Bang singularity is replaced by a quantum bounds on those models. The bounds is followed by a robust phase of superinflation. Superinflation age grows with time. This is why it is called superinflation, because in a standard inflation, age is constant. And five, interestingly, the full quantum dynamics, including the bounds, is well approximated by effective equations, and I am showing just an example of the Friedman equation with quantum corrections. Let's go to slide number 8, please. Now, an important question arises. Is inflation natural in loop quantum cosmology? Well, let's first assume that there exists a scalar field and a given potential. And now, let us allow all the possible initial conditions for the homogeneous part of the inflaton field at the bounds, subject, of course, to the Hamiltonian constraint. Then the question is, are most of the trajectories or of the dynamical trajectories such that slow roll inflation compatible with observation happens? Well, this question has been answered recently by Aspekar and David Sloan, and the answer is the following. For a broad family of potentials, almost all dynamical trajectories undergo a period of slow roll inflation compatible with observations. In numbers, the probability of having inflation compatible with observations is greater than 0.999997, but this number is obtained for a quadratic potential, but the generic picture is valid for a broad family of potentials. In my opinion, this is an unexpected and a remarkable result that is telling us that inflation happens naturally in loop quantum cosmology. Then the question is, Are you telling me that inflation is unavoidable in Luquant cosmology? No, no. The answer is no. Inflation is unavoidable only if you assume the existence of a scalar field and a phase in which the matter density is dominated by a scalar field. So let's go to next slide, please. Slide number 9. So if we assume the existence of this inflaton field, inflation happens naturally in Luquant cosmology. At first, this result seems bad news, because if this is true, that means that there are no significant deviations with respect to the inflationary predictions for the background, because it seems that inflation is a kind of attractor. However, in fact, these are not bad news, but this is good news, because this result opens a window to study perturbations on the inflationary background, and this make contact with observation. So let me talk now about perturbations during inflation. In the last few years, there has been a lot of work about perturbations in inflation. For instance, the French group have worked out holonomy corrections in tensor perturbations. Also, Martin Boyoval, Gianluca Calcani, and Sujikawa have worked inverse volume corrections in scalar and tensor perturbations. And then, Luke quantum gravity effects can be incorporated into the study of perturbations during inflation, and corrections to the inflationary predictions can be obtained. I think that this is a remarkable result, and it's very important, because in particular, one can use then CMB observations to constrain the Luke quantum cosmology correction. However, there is an important point here. The energy density during inflation is 11 orders of magnitude below the Planck scale. And this fact constitutes a huge handicap to make Luke quantum gravity corrections sizable during inflation. Let's go to slide number 10. However, before inflation, quantum gravity corrections can be important. And in fact, we know that they dominate near the bounds. So we came with the following idea. Can the pre-inflationary history of the universe, when quantum gravity corrections are of order 1, modify the initial conditions for perturbations? So let's remember what we did in inflation. In inflation, one assumes that the Banks-Davis vacuum is describing scalar perturbations at the onset of inflation. But now, if we think that the onset of inflation is just a given time in the history of the universe, why one should assume the vacuum state? Why is not one assuming a state with 10 particles or with 20 particles? Why the vacuum state at that intermediate time? Well, the old argument in cosmology is the following, is that the exponential expansion of the inflationary universe is going to dilute any possible quanta present in the initial state. So. And inflation is going to drive any arbitrary state to the Banks-Davis vacuum. If this is true, these are really bad news. But if this is true, that means that inflation is going to be able to wash off any of the information contained in the initial state of perturbation at the onset of inflation. But is this idea really true? Fortunately, the answer is no. Let's go to slide number 11, please. I showed at the beginning of the talk that inflation, starting from the Banks-Davis vacuum, is able to produce a spectrum of perturbations characterized by the power spectrum. And this happens because this effect of gravitationally induced spontaneous creation of particles by the expanding universe. And this was something that was first predicted by Leonard Parker in his thesis a lot of time ago. But generically, a spontaneous creation of quanta comes always together with the corresponding stimulated or induced counterpart. And recently, Parker and myself have proposed that if there are perturbations quanta present at the onset of inflation, then there is a gravitationally induced stimulated creation of quanta. This stimulated creation process is enhanced by the same amplification factor as is responsible for the spontaneous creation from the vacuum. This amplification factor grows enormously during inflation and compensates for the dilution of the particles initially present, keeping the average number density constant during inflation. That means that if we have a non-vacuum state at the onset of inflation, the spontaneous, the stimulated creation of quanta can produce observable consequences. So let's go to next slide. In this slide number 12, in this slide and in the following one, I want to summarize the main points of this work. Please, the details are not important. I just want to communicate the main idea. So what we did is to consider a generic state describing scalar perturbations at the onset of inflation, given by a generic density matrix. The form is not really important. This density matrix can contain a non-zero number of particles at the onset of inflation. And first of all, one can impose theoretical constraints over this initial number of particles. These theoretical constraints come for two different reasons. The first thing is that one has to ensure that this initial state is normalizable, or in other words, it has to be what is called a Hadamard state. Second, one has to assume that the back reaction of the initial particles in the background space-time has to be negligible. And these two conditions are going to constrain the number of initial particles. The strongest constraint comes from back reaction and tell us that the initial number of particles, which is given by the trace of rho times the number operator, has to be not much larger than one. Then one can work out the form of the power spectrum and the spectral index, and this is given in equation 3 and 4, where one obtained for the power spectrum is equal to the vacuum power spectrum times a factor, which depends on the initial number of particles. And now, from these predictions, one can use the observations of the CMB to constrain the initial number of particles. But the point is that one realizes that the power spectrum puts very mild conditions in the initial number of particles. In fact, the strongest condition comes from the spectral index and is telling us just that the logarithmic derivative of the number of initial number of particles with respect to k has to be small, has to be order epsilon, which is 1/100, more or less. So what I want to communicate in this slide is that the power spectrum itself has limited potential in revealing information about the initial state. So let's go to slide number 13. Again, the technical details are not important. So if the power spectrum is quite insensitive to the initial number of particles, one can go beyond the power spectrum. In particular, one can work out the three-point function. Remember that the power spectrum is related with the two-point function. So the three-point function, as I said at the beginning, if the spectrum of perturbations is purely Gaussian, the three-point function is zero. So this is why when one studies the three-point function, it's said that one studies the non-Gaussianities on the spectrum. And non-Gaussianities usually are characterized by this B, K1, K2, K3 function, which is the so-called bi spectrum, and there is a delta function, so K1 plus K2 plus K3 has to be zero, they have to form a triangle. And in the last years, there is a huge excitement in the cosmological community with non-Gaussianities, because non-Gaussianities have been proven to be a very sharp tool to test many aspects of the inflationary dynamics. In particular, non-Gaussianities is a very sharp tool to test the initial state of perturbations at the onset of inflation. The details of the slide are not important. So what I want to communicate is, first of all, the presence of particles at the onset of inflation produces an enhancement of the non-Gaussianities in a very peculiar configuration. And second, that the forthcoming observations of the CMB and the galaxy distributions are going to be very sensitive to the form of this particular configuration of non-Gaussianities. So the forthcoming observational signatures, the forthcoming observations of the CMB and galaxy distribution are going to be able to measure this kind of non-Gaussianities. So let's go to slide number 14. The summary of this.
Question from the Albert Einstein Institute.
Yes.
Can I ask you a question about the? In fact, it's probably better to look at the previous slide, number 12. Yes.
What?
So the question is, isn't there here, in a sense, also an assumption about the number of e-foldings of inflation not being too large, in the sense that on the one hand, you have these requirements that in the UV it cannot be for very short wavelength modes, it cannot be very populated, so that's the condition that you have there. But on the other hand, if you had a large number of e-foldings, then what would happen is that your initial stake would essentially be, again, diluted, and you would the contributions that correspond to observable scales nowadays, in the last that left the horizon during the last 60 e-foldings, those would correspond to wavelengths that were not very populated according to that condition. So if you have a very, very long period of inflation, then presumably these effects should be very small. Of course, if you assume that inflation does not long for a very large number of e-foldings, then you can have something like that, maybe with a correction which is not completely negligible. But if inflation lasts for a very long time, then it would seem that the standard picture that everything gets diluted and you recover the essentially the Minkowski vacuum, the result for the for the De Sitter vacuum, for the Van Zeewolde vacuum. So it's just this point that it seems that you get a non-negligible correction if inflation doesn't last for a very long time.
Okay, my point of view is that this is not the case. The reason that I am presented here why the initial presence of particles produce observable effect is because there is a stimulated creation of particles due to the expansion of the universe in such a way that the number density of particles remain constant during inflation. So the particles are not going to be diluted if you have 50 foldings or if you have 100 foldings. The average number density of particles is going to remain constant during the exponential expansion, precisely because this stimulated creation effect. It is true that in all this game there is an assumption about the a kind of mild assumption about the number of e-foldings, but it comes from a different reason. It comes from the fact that that if the number of e-foldings during inflation is too large, let's say it's larger than 70 or 80 foldings, then the modes that we are observing today in the CMB were sub-Planckian at the onset of inflation, were smaller than the Planck length at the onset of inflation. And then it is not justified to use just a standard quantum field theory in curved space-time. But regarding the dilution of the initial particles, there is no any assumption about the number of e-foldings.
Ivan, what you're saying is that if the number of e-foldings was much larger than, say, 80, then, in fact, we don't know anything, strictly speaking, because even the standard conclusion is not really valid for inflation because the modes that are of relevance for observations at the onset of inflation were sub-Planckian, and it doesn't matter which, whether in, even if you had a Budge-Davies vacuum, if you like, the use of anything like Budge-Davies vacuum or populated state, all of those things would be just not justified anymore. The whole paradigm has to be rethought. Is that what you're saying?
No, not really. So what I was saying is that here I was, one doesn't know for sure, but one can assume that there's some kind of adiabaticity argument and assume that the transplanting problem is really not a big problem. So that's not what I was saying. What I was saying is that my understanding was that if you consider a very, you just assume, let's say, that you do the calculation assuming that quantum field theory in curved space-time is valid all the way. You don't question this issue of the Trans-Planckian problem. Let's just say for the moment that you do that. I'm not saying that this is justified, but let's say that you do that. Then I would have expected that if you, even if you start with a slightly excited state, but with this condition that he has, I guess, that for the very short wavelength modes, you don't have a lot of population, because otherwise the back reaction would be too large and you wouldn't even have inflation to begin with. So if they are not very populated, then when you wait for a sufficiently long time, then essentially what you would see is the same result as you have for the Van Zeewolde vacuum. So he was mentioning this result that they got due to stimulated amplification. So I must say that I'm not familiar with that. But on the other hand, I wonder what's the connection with other studies that exist about the fact that you get for a sufficiently long period of inflation, no matter what initial state you start with, you recover at very late times, at sufficiently late times, the results for the Van Zeewolde vacuum. And there have been studies about that for free fields, but recently even for interacting theories. So I'm not sure, but I guess I should check that reference. I'm not sure how their result is related to these other studies that exist that tell you that, for simplicity, let's say that you have this calculation. Quantum field theory in the state of space-time, you see that you start with a different state from the a state which is different from the Van Zeewolde vacuum, and at sufficiently late time, you recover the Van Zeewolde vacuum, the same observables the observables at sufficiently late time would be equivalent to those, or would become very close to those of the Van Siebes vacuum. But anyway, I mean, as far as I understood, he was saying that there's a crucial simulated emission process here that sort of maintains this deviation from the Van Siebes vacuum. But that's what seems very surprising to me, because I'm aware of some of these and more or less familiar with some of these results. And so these would seem to be in conflict with those, but I guess I would need to look at the details to know for sure.
Okay, this is exactly what I am saying. I am saying that the stimulated process is going to make these initial particles observable, and there are computations for a standard, for instance, 60 number of defaultings, so 65, and the effect of the initial particles remain present. It is true that the power spectrum itself is not very sensitive to these effects. However, if one studies non-Gaussianities, things are different, and non-Gaussianities are very sensitive to the initial presence of particles. This is our claim.
But if you had 1,000 defaultings, let's say, if I understood your previous answer, you were saying that even if I had 1,000 defaultings, you would still get the correction which would not be completely negligible.
Exactly.
Is that right, or maybe I misunderstood? So that's the point that seems very strange to me, based on these other results that I'm familiar with. But I don't want to keep you to interrupt you anymore. So maybe just continue.
Let's continue. We can discuss it later.
Thank you.
Let's go then to slide number 14. In slide number 14, I was trying to summarize the couple of slides before. And what I am saying is that by observing the non-Gaussianities in the CMB and in the galaxy distribution, we can get detailed information about the state of the scalar perturbations at the onset of inflation. And in particular, this is the idea that we want to use to try to find observational signatures of quantum gravity. So let's go to slide number 15. And let's study our concrete proposals toward the observations of low quantum gravity effects. First of all, one has to realize that the quantum state describing scalar perturbations at the onset of inflation depends on the pre-inflationary history of the universe. Second, loop quantum gravity provides a complete picture of the pre-inflationary history of the universe. This is what I have tried to illustrate in the picture. Third, from the GR perspective, it is more natural to specify then the initial conditions of the quantum state for perturbations at the Big Bang, because it's the origin of everything, but because it is a singularity, it is not possible. However, in loop quantum gravity, it is possible, and one can specify initial conditions at the bounds. And this is what we want to do. Let's go to slide number...
Can you explain the diagram?
In the diagram, what is from Tion to the future, to the top of the graph, is exactly the same. It's the picture that I draw for inflation. Now, what I have added is the region from the T on to TB, which is the bound. So I want to say that loop quantum cosmology provides an explicit picture of the pre-inflationary history of the universe. So one can put initial conditions at the bound and study the evolution of perturbations until the onset of inflation. So let's go to slide number 16. So let me summarize the generic framework. Strictly, in order to study perturbations in this quantum space-time, one should study quantum field theory in a quantum space-time. In fact, the framework exists. It was developed a couple of years ago by Astekar, Kaminsky, and Lewandowski. And at the present, there is a program to use it in the inflationary context. However, to begin with, it is reasonable to use an approximation. The approximation, first of all, is to study perturbations, but not on the quantum space-time, but on the effective space-time of loop quantum gravity cosmology that replaces Freeman-Robertson-Walker. This is a smooth metric, but with coefficients containing important quantum corrections. So this is the first assumption, to study perturbations on the effective space-time. Now, what about the loop quantum gravity corrections to the perturbation equations? Well, the strategy that we want to follow is this one. We want to choose a background solution, what corresponds to choosing a particular value for the inflaton field at the bounds, such that the physical wavelength of all the observationally relevant modes is always well above the Planck length. In fact, this is the case because, for instance, if one chooses the reasonable value of phi at the bounds 0.95 in units of Planck masses, one realizes that all the physical wavelengths relevant for observations are in the range 2000 to 20 Planck lengths. So then it is reasonable to assume, as in the first step, that loop quantum gravity corrections to the evolution of these modes will be subdominant. So our proposal is to start by study these perturbations in the quantum spacetime, in the effective spacetime provided by loop quantum cosmology. So let's go to slide number 17.
Sorry, can I ask a question? So
sure.
In this computation which you have done, that you take this phi naught as 0.95 MPL and then you conclude the lambda in a particular range, can you spell the assumptions which you have made?
The assumption that I have made?
Yes.
The assumption that one made is just consider this value of phi at the bounds. I am assume a quadratic potential for the inflaton. With this quadratic potential, I have simulated the using the effective equation of loop quantum cosmology the background, and I have and then I have used the observational values of the power spectrum mass and spectral index coming from WMAP, and this tell me what are the physical wavelengths that we are observing now at the time in which this physical wavelength exited the Hubble radius during inflation. And then from that, because I know the history of the universe, because I have the simulations of the background, and I can propagate backwards in time this physical wavelength until the bounds, and then I can see what are the values of this physical wavelength at the bounds, and this is the result.
So one assumes that the classical values of the power spectrum and the mass of the inflaton?
Exactly.
Okay.
Because this is given by WMAP, and WMAP, if inflation is true, is measuring the stuff that happens during inflation where quantum corrections are negligible. Can I continue?
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go to slide number 17. Now, let's talk about what are the initial conditions at the bounds. Now we want to use this quantum field theory on this effective spacetime, but we find a problem. The problem is that in quantum field theory in curved spacetime, it is known that the quantum theory for a scalar field satisfying the Klein-Gordon equation, for this equation, there is a problem with the constructing a Fock space at a given time. If one chooses a natural Fock representation at a given time, this representation is unitarily inequivalent to that at another instant of time, and this is manifest in the fact that the vacuum evolves to a state with infinite number of particles at an arbitrary small future time. This is a standard problem in quantum field theory, but fortunately there has been a solution to this problem in the near past by the Iberian group, Cortés, Guillermo Mena Marugán, Olmedo and Beliño, and the answer is the following. First of all, the quantum field theory of a massless scalar field in an expanding universe is equivalent to the quantum field theory of a scalar field satisfying the Klein-Gordon equation in Minkowski spacetime, but with a time-dependent mass. So one can switch the information or the non-trivial information of the background spacetime to a time-dependent mass. And second, for this scalar field, there is a canonical defined Fock space representation. Vacuum at any time evolves to a well-defined number of particles at any other later instant of time. So our proposal is to use this quantization for the quantum perturbations on the effective space provided by loop quantum cosmology. So let's go to slide number 18. Now the million-dollar questions are, let's imagine that we start with the vacuum state at the bounds and we evolve it to the onset of inflation. The first question is, will this state give a state close to the Banks-Davis vacuum at the onset of inflation, or will it be so And will it be observationally ruled out by observation? The answer is unclear because the density during this evolution drops around 11 orders of magnitude. And additionally, there is a lot of time for Luquan cosmology dynamics to make a difference. Second, will this state be so close to the Bynes-Davis vacuum that it will be undistinguishable from it? In fact, this second option is what cosmologists generally assume. Then our claim is the following. There is a window of background spacetimes which is compatible with observations, for which the state at the onset of inflation is compatible with observations. Additionally, in this window, the state is not exactly the Bynes-Davis vacuum at the onset of inflation, but there are particles present. So now, in order to quantify these statements, what one has to do is to assume the vacuum state at the bounds, evolve it to the onset of inflation, and compute what is the number of particles generated during this evolution. So let's go to next slide, 19, and I want to summarize this computation. The average number of particles created in the mode K can be computed using the technique of Bocquelieu-Bohm's transformation in curved spacetime. So one quantizes the scalar field as I described at the beginning of the talk. And now I want to call RK to the mode function corresponding to the notion of vacuum at the bounds. So the state annihilated by the annihilation operators associated with this RK is going to be the vacuum state at the bounds. Second, I want to call RBD to the mode function corresponding to the Bynes-Davis vacuum during inflation. And now I can start with RK at the bounds and evolve it to the onset of inflation. And at the onset of inflation, because RBD and RBD complex conjugated is a complete basis of mode functions, I always can write RK as a combination of RBD and RBD complex conjugated. And the coefficients of the linear combination are this alpha K and beta K, and they satisfy that alpha square minus beta square is equal 1. These alpha and beta square are the so-called Bogoliubov coefficients. And in particular, the average number of particles created in the mode K, it is given just by the absolute value square of the beta coefficient. So this is what one has to compute. And if we go to slide number 20, I'm going to show you just a preliminary computation. This computation shows, this plot shows the form of theta squared coefficients as a function of K. And in particular, this profile for the particles created satisfies all the constraints and in addition is big enough to produce observable signatures. However, as I said at the beginning of the talk, this is a work in progress and it is not impossible that new issues arise in this framework. So let's go to slide number 21, and I want to summarize the main points of this talk. Here, I want to summarize the points related with inflation and quantum field theory in curved spacetimes. First of all, we have mentioned that inflation provides a compelling mechanism that satisfactorily accounts for the primordial cosmic perturbations responsible for the inhomogeneities in the present universe. Second, the stimulated creation of quanta during inflation makes the inflationary predictions sensitive to the quantum state of perturbations at the onset of inflation. And three, by observing the non-Gaussianities in the CMB and galaxy distribution in the so-called squeeze configuration, we can obtain detailed information about the initial state of scalar perturbations at the onset of inflation. Now, let's go to slide number 22. It is 22 of 21. It is kind of funny. Didn't realize. The conclusions for quantum cosmology are the following. First of all, by assuming the existence of a scalar field and a potential, a phase of slow-roll inflation compatible with observations naturally appears in loop quantum cosmology. Second, the main features of the pre-inflationary history of the universe, when quantum gravity corrections dominate, can be imprinted in the state of perturbations at the onset of inflation. That means that observations of the non-uniformities of the universe open a window to explore phenomenological aspects of quantum field theory in Earth spacetime and quantum gravity. And in this talk, we have presented a first attempt to quantitatively analyze those questions, although this is a work in progress. And this is basically all what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Questions? Well, so I have a question. If you go to slide 17, what you say there at the beginning is that quantum fields here in Earth space-time, there's no natural fuck vacuum. That is true, of course, in general, but when you're looking at the effective space-time of LQC, isn't it still homogeneous, and therefore you still can define just a fuck vacuum?
But I don't see how homogeneity can you define a singular Fock representation.
Well, not just homogeneity. There has to be a time-like killing vector, right? So I guess the idea is that the effective space-time of LQC doesn't have that, unlike FRW.
FRW also doesn't have it, right? It's an expanded field.
But people could still speak about particle production in FRW, right?
No, but in order to define particle production, you have to define, if you want, a early time region in which you have a time like killing vector field. So in this early region, you can define particles, and the same for a late time region. But if you have a generic expanding universe, the notion of particles at a given time is not well defined. Exactly, because you don't have a time-like killing vector field.
Okay.
Maybe I can just add a little point about this, which is that,
yeah.
In fact, this solution that he's mentioning about from the Iberian group, so this is something that, in fact, in the community studying quantum field theory in robust, in curved space-time, but in particular in Robertson Walker space-time, I would say has been known for quite some time. So there are different approaches, but some of them are actually exactly what he was mentioning here. So the fact that there are particular representations in which you have unitary evolution and you have between different Fock spaces, but which are unitarily equivalent at different times. So I would say that, I mean, this is a sort of known result in the literature.
Okay. So who are the people? I mean, so we attribute them correctly? Who are the people before the Iberian?
One of the old, I can try to look it up and tell you. One of the first that I can think of is, what's his name? It's Nathania, it's an 80s paper, or late 80s paper, Nathaniel.
Okay, it will be very
great. I can look it up and I can send you an email with the
record. We'll be most grateful to know that. But because Hori asked this question, let me just say it. So in the very early days in quantum field theory in Kurth space-time, what people tried to do was to define a Fock representation at each instant of time, right? I mean, in other words, what was called instantaneous diagonalization of the Hamiltonian. And so you try to define in the Friedman-Robertson-Walker model, for example, using spatial homogeneity as kind of a vacuum state at each instant of time. But what they quickly realized, and in fact it was Castagnino who I think showed this in a communications paper, if you did that, then between two slices there is an infinite number of particle creation. In other words, these representations are all unitarily inequivalent to each other. And that is why this problem has been, what do we do if in a truly dynamical situation in which you do not have kind of approximate staticity in the beginning and approximate staticity at the end, but really dynamical situation, what do you do? And so, I guess the general idea was to transform this problem to something else. And as we just learned, this idea is not just more recent one, but apparently was known in the 80s. But the general idea is to transform this problem to another one. Classically, it is completely equivalent to time-dependent massive scalar field, but in a static background. And then the statement was that in the static background, there is a representation which implements the dynamics unitarily, and that is what one is using. So apparently this was known in the 80s, and that is what one is using here.
Right. So I think what you're referring to is that originally people were trying to do this Hamiltonian diagonalization at each instant of time. And it's true that in general that does not work. So for instance, Fuling, I think that in the late 70s perhaps even, he sort of pointed out that for Bianchi-type universes, for instance, that would not work, and then it's better to define things using tools closer to adiabatic vacua and so on. However, for some special cases, like Robertson-Walker spacetimes, then you can see that you do have some representations, like this one, where there's no problem. There you have unitarily equivalent Hilbert spaces at different times. By the way, yeah, it's a PRD paper, might be 87 or 89, and the author is Nathan Weiss. But I can send you an email with the exact reference.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is Laurent. I have a question. So my understanding is that, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that you show that in fact, you know, if you have a you know, that the status of the vacuum states register into the non-Gaussian ET. That's the result you established. So, but I don't see the connection with LQC because in any theory there will be these questions about what is the initial state you start with. Bonjevis is one proposal, but even if you find this non-Gaussianity and you detect, you know, some I don't know, you get some information about a different vacua state than the Bonjevis vacua, you know, there's nothing special about LQC here, unless there was a prediction that there's a unique vacua state that has to come up, you know, unique initial data. Am I wrong?
So the statement is that there are two parts to the answer. The first part is that if you're asking, is there a natural sense in which LQC leads to a certain prediction of non-Gaussianity? The answer would be, if this program is completed and completely satisfactorily and so on, the answer would be yes. And the statement would be that you give yourself some initial data for the perturbation, for the quantum state of the perturbation, and the bounds, which is selected by symmetries of the problem in a qualitative sense. Now one might say, well, yeah, but I don't want to look at the symmetries of the problem. I want to do something else and so on. Well, then I don't know anything. I mean, that, we use the symmetry of the problem here. So the statement would be there'll be some definite prediction that, which would say that, assuming the symmetry of the problem, there is a certain state, and this state evolves. So there will be a certain state at the bounds, and then this state evolves to something specific at the onset of inflation, which has certain non-Gaussianity. So that is kind of the best-case scenario. Now, the second question that one can ask is that, is this a watertight solution, in the sense that, is this, in fact, a prediction of LQC which cannot be reproduced by anything else? And the answer to that is no. I mean, it could be that there is some other idea. Here, the only thing that one can say is that there is a theory which sort of goes back to the Big Bounce, so that initially we do not have a singularity, and in that theory, which is a candidate, which comes from some candidate theory of quantum gravity, here is a prediction. And so that is all one can say. One cannot say that this cannot be reproduced by some completely different reasoning. Now I'll
answer
you.
That's just a precision. So concerning the first scenario, the first part of the answer, so you're saying that in some sense you're hoping that this bounce in some sense wash out some detail about the choice of initial state before the bounce. Is that what you're expecting?
Yeah, that's the idea. The idea is that in general relativity one might have put the initial state to the, I mean, one would like to put it at the Big Bang, but one can't get out. And one is now putting it at the box. That's right. And then there is altogether a second problem about, you know, can we really know what is happening in the pre-bounce universe and so on and so forth. There is a second kind of chapter in the whole story. But there's one chapter in which one says that, well, let's not worry about what happened in the past, whatever could have happened in the past. If the initial condition was this, then there would be this inflation. We know from this work with David Sloan that generically,
not only is there a long enough inflation, etc., but in fact, there is inflation generically, the trajectories actually go through the phase space region where the observed or the desired slow roll inflation with the observed values of the slow roll parameters actually occurs. And so the statement is that, well, we just begin here and then we go on.
Okay, thanks.
So if I can go back to the question that arose during the talk, because I really think that this is a crucial point and that many cosmologists would be perhaps concerned about this. And so let me try to phrase. I think that there are three questions that are related. The main point in my view is that there's this crucial assumption that you are not considering a long period of inflation. And so in connection with that, there are two other questions. One is that it seemed that part of the motivation was related to the so-called Transplanckian problem, meaning that if you have much, much longer inflation, then the scales which are observable nowadays would correspond to scales that at the onset of inflation were much, much shorter than the Planck length. So that's one question. In that respect, there are arguments that would tell you that maybe the Transplanckian problem is not such a big problem, that you can have some sort of adiabaticity as long as you have a large separation of scales between the Planck scale and the Hubble scale, and then the important thing is not so much what's the initial state at the onset of inflation, but actually that later on, when the modes are still well within the horizon, but with a wavelength which is much larger than the Planck length, that they are essentially at the ground state in the Van't Hid vacuum. And, okay, so that's a question which is not completely closed. You would need a proper microscopic theory to tell for sure, but it's not completely unreasonable based on adiabaticity arguments if you have this large separation of scales, and there are some models based on modified dispersion relations and so on, illustrating that this is not so strange that something like that could happen. So then the point is that if you are comfortable with having a long period of inflation where you're comfortable with the fact that maybe there's not such a Transplanckian problem, then the other question is, in such a situation, starting with a relatively generic initial state, provided that it's not very, very populated at short wavelengths, do you at sufficiently late times recover results which are very, very, very close to those of Van't Hid? And that's where Ivan was quoting these results that they got, but they seem to be, in my view, they seem to be in tension with other results existing in the literature. But I'm just insisting on this point because, in my view, this is the crucial point in the whole talk. So there are two points. One is that you need to assume that inflation doesn't last for a very long period of time if you have this effect where arbitrary initial states will tend at sufficiently late times to give you the same kind of results as the Van't Hid vacuum, or the other is this result that he was mentioning that you have stimulated emission, and so even that will last for that will survive a very long period of inflation. But that's where there seems to be a tension with a number of results existing in the literature that imply the opposite.
Okay. I don't know what kind of papers do you refer, but I mean, I have discussing about several cosmologists about that, and all of them agree, and even you can read this in books and from discussions with very important people in cosmology, and they all agree that a non-vacuum initial state is not going to wash out completely. For my computations, I can tell you that even if you have, let's imagine that you populate as a first assumption all the modes with the same number of particles. Then, with that assumption, you are going to the number density of particles are going to be constant with time. But what you are saying is that because you want to have a Hadamard state, a well-defined state at high energies, and because you always want to have a negligible back reaction, you cannot have a huge number of particles at large modes. So the number of particles has to decrease with the mode, with the momentum. So if you have a big enough number of e-foldings, then what you are observing now corresponds to the high energy part to the high K values of this initial quanta, and so because they are small, you are not going to have any observation. This is what are you
saying? That's the qualitative description. You perfectly describe it, but what I'm saying is that is actually, in my view, that is actually backed by a number of calculations. It's not just a qualitative expectation, but there are... But yes, that's what I'm saying. You describe it very well.
And what is the number of e-foldings that... Do you know the number of e-foldings that requires to have...
Well, that depends. There's an interplay, of course, depending on how excited your initial state is and up to what wavelength. So then it's a matter, of course, of a certain fine-tuning. So if I tell you that a given number of e-foldings, you could always cook up a certain state. If the number of e-foldings is extremely large, then you would need to have a state which would be populated at very, very, very short wavelengths. So,
okay.
But it's one of these games where if I just give you a number of e-foldings, you could always cook up a state. Although, well, no, maybe not, because if I give you a very, very high number of e-foldings, then if you try to cook up the state which is populated at sufficiently short wavelengths, then probably you would have just what you were mentioning. But then you would have a strong back reaction, and maybe you wouldn't have inflation to begin with. Right. So maybe you can actually sort of estimate a certain number of e-foldings. But that I'm not so sure whether that has been done in great detail or not.
Okay. Then I have not done the computations considering an arbitrarily large number of e-foldings, so I cannot claim that what happens in that case. What I can claim is that in the case in which you consider a reasonable number of e-foldings, let's say 60, 65, 70, this effect appears and is compatible with back reaction and renormalizability of the initial state. This is what I can claim at this point, and what we are using in this work.
So to that I don't have any objection. All I was saying is that if you have a very long number of e-foldings, and then the question is how natural it is to have an inflationary model with just about 60 or so e-foldings, but then I think we agree. I mean, if you have 60 e-foldings or so, I can perfectly believe that you get this result. But my point is that if you have a much larger number of e-foldings, then I would expect that you just get extremely close. The corrections are very, very small. And so that's why I'm saying that then it seems that the crucial assumption in all this is assuming that the number of e-foldings of inflation is not very big, not much larger than 60.
Okay. So if the number of inflation is actually, if the number of e-foldings is much larger than that, then as... Ivan was showing us one of his view graphs, then what would happen is that at the bounds, the wavelength of the modes would actually be in the regime compared to the Planck length are smaller, so that these Planck scale effects are going to be important. I mean, from loop quantum cosmology and from the graviton propagator calculations, it appears that when the modes have length which is about greater than 10 Planck length, then the effects of pure quantum geometry effects, quantum gravity effects, are not going to be important. But below that, they are going to be important. So then in that case, one really has to do the calculation in this quantum fields and quantum space-time. Quantum fields and quantum space-times, not classical space-times. And it's a new ballgame altogether. I don't have any intuition that then there's... Nonetheless, these effects, because of quantum fields and quantum space-times, these effects will still be there, and one would be able to distinguish. But for large number of e-foldings, the calculation has to be done in a kind of a new paradigm as far as we are concerned, because we started the bounce.
So the only comments are, I agree. In fact, I guess that it would be nice to do, if one can, this calculation and check these arguments based on adiabaticity that I was mentioning before. If you have a microscopic model, then you can come and try to check them. So the only intuitive argument for the time being would be that if you have a long period of inflation, then you can look at the modes which are, at a given time, if it's lasting for a very long time, at every time you can look at those modes that were initially transplanckian, but now they are sort of in an intermediate range. They are much larger than the Planck length, but their wavelength is still shorter than the size of the horizon. And then if they were not very close to the vacuum, to the Van Tievit vacuum or the Minkowski vacuum, where they have a much shorter wavelength than the than the horizon size, they are essentially equivalent. So if they were not all those motors, you look during all these long periods of inflation, were not in the ground state as they are about to leave the horizon, then their back reaction could be important, and you had this very long period of inflation. So what I'm saying is that I think it would be very nice if you have a specific microscopic model to do the calculation and try to see whether this point is true or not, that the modes are essentially always, because of adiabaticity type of reasons, essentially in the ground state. But otherwise, one would need to check that the back reaction coming from them is not modifying the background solution that you have. But all these, of course, would only be important if you have a very large number of effaults.
Yeah, I agree. So I think the first step, so to set the whole problem, was to even see if there was any scenario at all which is compatible with many constraints, the observational constraint as well as constraints coming from dynamics of LQC, which tells you how many e-foldings there would be between the big bounce and the onset of inflation. So the question was, putting everything together, is there some interesting scenario, interesting regime in which one can do the first tractable and reasonably easy calculations involving this quantum field theory in quantum space-times, in classical space-times, quantum field theory in classical third space-times? And the answer turned out to be yes. There is this window in which you could have certain number of, I mean, given by loop quantum cosmology, even if in which you will have certain number of e-foldings between the big bounce and the onset of standard inflation, such that quantum field theory in curved space-time still would be a good approximation. So this itself was a surprise, and the calculation is being just carried out in this window. And I agree that if this is all successful, then one has to worry about robustness and carry out calculations in this other windows where there is large number of e-foldings between the big bounce and the onset of standard inflation. And then one has to use quantum field theory, as you say, microscopic model, quantum field theory in quantum space-times and see what happens. I agree, it's a very interesting problem, and we are really only at the beginning part of the problem.
Okay, thank you.
So I have kind of a follow-up to this. You give the window in terms of values of the scalar field at the bounce. Can you tell me what those values are? Because, I mean, on slide 16, you say that the fine order is 0.95 in Planck mass. The minimum length of your wavelength is 20 times the Planck length. So just one more e-folding, it seems to me, would put you in this problematic region. So it seems like you're examining a very small window.
Yes, you are right. On the one hand, the minimal value of phi at the bounce is as you know, is 0.94. But there is a window, not very high, not very, right, very large, but there is a window in which the physical wavelengths are larger than the Planck length. It is not really huge, but there is that window, and this is what we are exploring here.
Right. Well, I mean, really, there are two windows, right, depending on the sine of phi dot at the bounce.
Exactly, because everything is symmetric, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there should be one window about 0.94, and there should be one window around 5.5 or something. Are you examining both or just the 0.94?
So far, we have only analyzed one window because, as I said, this is the first attempt. But as you said, there are two windows, and it will be interesting to explore both of them.
Okay, thank you.
And then the general, I mean, there is this philosophical thing which I don't want to really discuss too much. But the idea is also, how did the inflaton get at this initial state itself? And one would argue something like Heisenberg-Uncertainty principle or something, and that would favor lower values of phi. But this is also something that has to be developed much more carefully. But I think there's a conceptual reason to favor the lower values of phi than higher values of phi. But this is all to be developed.
Yeah, well, I'm not really sure about that because, I mean, if you just look at the time reverse solutions, right, I mean, these are just as valid. And so you could look at the pre-bounce phase. It seems to me there's no reason to prefer low values if you have a deflaton or something becoming your inflaton.
This is all heuristic, and I think it's not. We can discuss it privately. I think it's not worth taking everybody's time on this.
Sorry. More questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.